We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give a special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. This is a periodic, used to be monthly, might be monthly again someday, probably not next month, but periodically we get together and we talk about what is often a classic chess book. I'd say this month's, quote-unquote, month's selection fits the criteria, and we are joined by a returning guest, longtime friend of the pod. This will be his sixth appearance on Perpetual Chess. He's a highly respected cognitive scientist with a PhD from Harvard, the co-author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Invisible Gorilla, with fellow chess player Daniel Simons. He's also a USCF master. He published the award-winning American Chess Journal and a few chess books. He's a chess dad, a chess bibliophile, and most importantly, the co-author of the forthcoming book, Nobody's Fool, Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It, coming July 2023. If you've enjoyed our guest appearance on the show, you might want to pre-order that book. But without further ado, let's welcome back Dr. Christopher Chabris to the show. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, good to be here for the sixth time. Am I the record setter now, or is somebody still ahead of me?
I think you might be tied. I don't know, but I won't verbally go through it and stutter through it okay. For minutes and torture people. But you're in the conversation, which is all we can really ask for. Okay. And we do greatly appreciate it. I know that you're a busy guy. You've been finishing this book, so all the more appreciated. And the book we settled on, San Luis 2005, From Quality Chess. By Alik Gershon and Igor Nor. So Chris, did you have any background with this book? I know we batted around a few ideas once you volunteered to do this as you finished your book.
I have heard of this book a number of times, and it's been recommended to me as sort of one of the great tournament books of all time and one of the great tournaments of all time. As well. And I have a lot of other tournament books, although I'm by no means a collector. So it occurred to me that I didn't think you had really covered too many tournament books in the series. Also, most of the books are memoirs or improvement books and so on. And tournament books have a sort of exalted place among chess book collectors, I think. They're people who really are connoisseurs of tournament books per se and think that they're sort of like a high art form when it comes to chess books. So I thought it would be interesting to look at one of those. And I know you talked about the most famous one of all, Zurich 1953, on a previous episode, I think. And I didn't, I thought of New York 1924 also, but I don't really like that one as much as everybody else does. So this really seemed like it was really highly thought of, and I had never cracked it open before. So why not?
Yeah, I was sort of in the same boat. Again, New York 1924, highly praised. I have not read the whole thing. I know Jesse Cry is a big fan. I actually did check it out a little bit just to sort of see what the hype was about, and it looked good. I read the first chapter, but maybe some future pod. But for this one, I was in the mood for something more contemporary. And like you, I've heard rave reviews for this book, and it's one of those books that was sitting on my shelf anyway. I bought it at some point. So I thought, why not read it? And it is interesting from a historical perspective, from a World Chess Championship perspective, because of what was going on at the time. I mean, it was such a unique time. What are your memories of those early 2000 controversial World Championship periods, Chris?
So my memories of that period in chess is that I had sort of stopped playing seriously by the late 90s. I think 1998 was my last tournament for 15 years. And so in the early 2000s, I was sort of paying attention as a consumer of news, more than someone who went through all the games as they were being played and so on, the way I had been before. So I sort of had vague memories of the news of what was going on and the complexities of the World Championship cycle and the reunification attempts at the World Championship, which were very intensive then. And Kasparov retiring was really the big news of 2005 in my mind, because he was the most important player of my life, except for Bobby Fischer, I guess. So I didn't really know that much about it. I had to go back and re-examine what the history was and how this tournament came about and why the players who were in it and why the ones who weren't in it weren't in it. And it was it's kind of an interesting story, like what the role of this tournament was in the whole long process of bringing the World Championship back to one person, to one lineage.
Yeah, exactly. And I was in a similar boat, obviously checking the headlines and stuff, but wasn't following chess as closely as I have been since this podcast started back in those days. And we might as well catch listeners up for any newer chess fans or people who are a little hazy on the details. But basically, Kasparov started a sort of rival faction to FIDE in the 1990s. So for a while, instead of there being undisputed world champions, there were disputed world champions. And then Kramnik had beaten Kasparov in 2000 and defended his title against Lecoq in 2004. This is the Kasparov auspices title. And meanwhile, FIDE has switched their formats to knockout tournaments for the World Championship, which is a subject of some controversy. Sometimes you'll hear people say that the people who won that, like Alexander Kalifman and Ruslan Ponomaryov, and Kazhimzhanov, who participated in this tournament, you'll hear, you know, armchair critics say that they're not real champions. To me, that's not our role as chess fans to say, but they're not classical champions. This was a knockout tournament, a very different format than we're used to with the matches. So this was the continuation of that. But the idea, as Chris said, is that they're going to unify, hopefully, after the match. So out of the top 15 players in the world, Kramnik declined to participate because he already considered himself the world champion. And Kasparov, of course, was no longer playing, even though his rating would still be on the top of the list. Was there anyone else missing amongst the top players?
I think there were a couple, but not for nefarious reasons. I don't think. I think they mostly just went down the rating list to substitute people. So I think Judit Polgár was in the top 10 at that time, which is how she got into this 8-player tournament, because she was one of, like, the first reserve, you know, to get in. It's interesting that Kazhimzhanov and Adams were in because they were the finalists in that knockout tournament the year before.
Right.
that's how they got in. It was quite a strong tournament. I sort of view it kind of like a candidates tournament almost, even though it wasn't, but it's very much the structure of it. It's an 8-player double round robin, just like the candidates tournaments we have nowadays. So it's a long tournament, but there aren't too many games going on at once. And it seems like overall a pretty fair test of strength, given what you can accommodate nowadays. You can't have 30 round tournaments anymore like they would do, 100 years ago or something. So it's a reasonable format and a very strong list of players. I think Sfidler was maybe another one who sort of came off the reserve list to get in.
Sfidler was number 7 at the time. But yeah, to your point about the candidates tournament, one thing that it ended up serving exactly that function, because of course Topalov won the tournament and then did ultimately have the reunification match with Kramnik in 2006, which of course Kramnik won. So it had very controversial with the toilet gate that was that we discussed in some recent cheating pods, and there's cheating in this story as well, as we will get, or alleged cheating, I should say, as well. But just to name the participants, as we mentioned, Topalov, who was ranked number 3 at the time, Viswanathan Anand, who was number 2, Sfidler, number 7, Alexander Morozevich, number 14, Peter Lecoq, number 4, Rustam Kazymjanov, as Christopher said, number 35, so lower by rank, but he qualified through the prior world championship. Michael Adams, number 13, and Judit Polgár, who was number 8, and a bit off form. Actually, we briefly discussed this in my interview with Mihail Marin, who was there with her as her second. She had just had a child, and this was her first time competing in about a year and a half. So that rounded out the field, and yeah, it was interesting tournament. It took place in a town in like sort of not very booming town, about 200,000 people in central Argentina. The tournament was in the same place as the hotel, and you've got the FIDE delegation there, the player delegation, the coaches delegation. And when you read, I of course never got the opportunity to attend a tournament like Linares in Spain, but Dirk Jansen Guzendum has like a great collection of essays about that, and you get this sort of cloistered feel as you read about these tournaments, where it's like it's in kind of a, I mean, all due respect to these beautiful towns, but kind of a random place, and the venue and the place where they're staying are the same. It's almost like a setup for like a murder mystery, where like everyone's so close together and in each other's stuff. And for a, world-class chess tournament to happen under those circumstances, I always find like, I'm sure what goes on behind the scenes is just as interesting as the chess itself.
I haven't experienced playing at that level, of course, but it seems to me that there are sort of two kinds of places where you have these tournaments. One is a major city, like world championship matches have been in New York, London, Moscow, Bonn, places like that. And then you've got sort of like these obscure little towns like Linares, which for quite a while was the most famous place in chess, I think is a pretty much tiny town where, again, everybody stays in the same hotel, like they sit across the room from each other at dinner and so on, or Vicence, which I don't think is a teeming metropolis.
Right.
Now, the number one tournament in the world. But then you've got St. Louis, so there's sort of like this history and many famous tournaments, I think, we know that, are in obscure places like Cambridge Springs. I live in Pennsylvania. Nobody even knows about Cambridge Springs here in Pennsylvania, where it is.
Right.
And you're from Pennsylvania, I think. I bet you never went to Cambridge Springs.
I've never been. Yeah, I've been to a lot of places in Pennsylvania.
But it's got a tournament and a defense,
Yeah.
So, I think it's an interesting, it's really interesting to think about the psychological, atmosphere of these events and things like the proximity to the other players. And I think there are pros and cons, right? If you're in a city, it seems like they cloister themselves just as much, right? I was reading in the Anon files that they would be playing in a major city, but they would basically just hole up in the hotel and go to the same restaurant every day or something,
right,
like,
yeah,
create their own little, cloistered space for themselves as a team or something anyhow.
Yeah, it does still seem like it would feel different when you're just all in the same venue, like Nigel Short alludes to in the introduction. he wrote an introduction, and Michael Marin also wrote a foreword, or it might be the other way around in terms of introduction versus foreword. But anyway, he talks about how, like, the first day he's not sure who to eat with, and he ends up eating with the Bulgarian contingent with Topalov and his team. And because he does that the first day, he ends up doing that every day, and it becomes a superstitious thing. But the whole sort of dining hall atmosphere, people eating together but not necessarily breaking bread, definitely adds to the lore. And of course, we should say the book is absolutely beautiful. I mean, one downside of this book is I couldn't find an e-version. It's not on Forward Chess, nope. and Quality Chess doesn't do Kindle. So you got to pony up for this book. It's like $40 or $50, but it's, as with Quality Chess books, the paper is beautiful and there's tons of photos, both of the players in competition and of the town. And it's really sort of evocative of, like, yes, they're kind of in this random hotel in, not a, mega center of Argentina, but at least it was the weather looks nice and it looks quite, picturesque on the bright side.
The book is printed on heavy paper, even heavier than the current Quality Chess books, which have sort of achieved this high quality but thin paper. So this is heavy. Like, you could do like some exercise with this book, just lifting it up. And it is really nicely done. And those photos are color, by the way, and they're almost every couple of pages. There's a great color photo. Sometimes it's a close-up of something. Often it's the players and interesting expressions while they're playing the games or analyzing or whatever. It is really beautifully done.
Yeah, so big fans of the book, both of us, I think it's safe to say. We'll get into the authors in a bit more about the context of the book as well as the tournament itself after we get back from this break. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable is the leading chess education platform known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which uses spaced repetition to help you remember stuff. What kind of stuff? Well, tactical patterns, opening sequences. It can even help you drill specific endgames. And of course, they have a huge library of courses to help you do that. They have courses both from prominent grandmasters like Grandmaster Jordan von Forrest, Magnus Carlsen, Sam Shanklin, and they also have great material for club players, from club players. They have stuff for purchase, stuff you can check out for free. So be sure to go to chessable.com and check out what they have that is new. You should know what that sound means. That's the sound of another sale on Shopify and the moment another business dream becomes a reality. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So whether you're selling chess courses, chess boards, or something totally unrelated to chess, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can focus on successfully growing your business. It covers every sales channel, whether it's in-person point of sale system or an all-in-one e-commerce platform. It even lets you sell across social media like TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. It gives you complete control over your business. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive course library, Shopify is there to help you every step of the way. What's incredible to me about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to revolutionize your business and take it to the next level. So now it's your turn to get serious about selling to Shopify. So sign up for $1 a month trial period, shopify.com/chess. By using the code chess, you know that they came from Perpetual Chess. So that's shopify.com/chess to take your business to the next level today. And we are back, and we should discuss the authors a bit, because I actually, other than having heard of this book, I was not familiar with either one of them, Grandmaster Alec Gershon and Igor Nor, who is about 2260 FIDE, both of them from Israel. Chris, did you have any familiarity with these gentlemen?
I feel like I've heard of Gershon before, maybe just because he's a grandmaster, so I've seen his name various places, but this is the most famous book I can think of where the authors have no fame at all or are not associated with it. We know My System is by Nimzowitsch and Zurich 1953 is by Bronstein and so on. And this one is odd in that way. I never really thought about it too much until we started talking about doing this book. So I went and looked them up because I wanted to see what else they had done. And as you know, I found that they had not done any other books before or since this one, which kind of surprised me because this one is so good. You imagine like someone who does things that are so good, they must do more. But this is really a one-hit wonder of chess books.
Yeah, and obviously we talked about this a bit as we were prepping for this pod because I had a similar experience. So we did do some research. We found an old article on Chessbase that was published a few years after the book came out. By the way, we should have said this book won the ECF Book of the Year in 2007 unanimously. So obviously we're not the only ones that are fans of this book, but basically the backstory was that they were both working as sort of chess reporters in Israel. Gershon was running an Israeli chess website, and they just decided to sort of cover the tournament in real time, and they were issuing these bulletins in real time. These, of course, are kind of, you know, early 2000s. The internet was firmly a thing, but obviously not of the scope and availability that it is now, and bandwidth, I should say, that it is now. But basically, they were just getting a lot of viewers, and people were amazed by the quality of it. And eventually, they decided to turn it into an English language book with quality chess.
Yeah, and I think they say that they, although they did a lot of work during the match, there's only so much you can do overnight, between rounds or something like that. Effectively making bulletins, sort of like tournament bulletins, but very deep ones. So the work in the book is much expanded and revised and edited by the quality chess team and so on. I don't recall whether they mentioned the extent to which they used computers to check their analysis, because in 2005, 2006, 2007, we're just on the precipice, I think, of computers being really an everyday tool for people. Do you remember what they said about computers, or if they said anything?
I don't remember offhand, yeah. No.
I don't think they mentioned it.
Yeah, so there are Lee Chess studies with the games, as is my custom. I didn't use a chess set to go through the games, and I think it was you who had sent me one of them, Chris. So you can call up the study and play through the moves on the computer, which is what I did. I didn't check the engine as much as I sometimes do in terms of like evaluating the author's analysis. I was generally quite impressed I felt like it was detailed, but not over the top, like basically the appropriate level of analysis. And to the extent I did check for errors, I mean, of course, there's stronger engines are always going to reveal more things. But I mean, there was obviously a lot of care put into to the analysis.
I didn't do that. I didn't do that kind of checking, but they worked so hard on it. And I think it's an interesting book because there's a deep analysis in the book. And so deep analysis from 2005 is bound to have mistakes when tested against how well we can do in 2023. But for me, the more interesting part of the book was the little lessons that they embedded in the games. I don't want to say they're lessons like didactic things with quizzes and so on, but they have very eloquent explanations of certain positions and openings and structures, and even some of the psychological aspects as well, like why did someone play this move right now, maybe the results of the round before, the tournament standing, and so on. They really weave that stuff together in a quite a nice way, I think. So regardless of like a few suboptimal, lines, I don't think it loses any value.
Yeah, I agree. And it's evident because, this was not the most suspenseful tournament. I mean, Topalov ran roughshod over the field in the first half, 6.5 out of the first seven, and he basically coasted the rest of the way. I mean, there was a moment where, like, if he lost to Black with Svidler in like the penultimate round or something, it would have been tied, something like that. But overall, I mean, he just was in cruise control the whole way. So, when I talked about Zurich 1953 with FM Nate Solon, friend of the pod, and got to interview Andy Soltis, we were saying like, the Nydorf, there's two Zurich 1950, well, more than two, but we discussed two.
There are several.
Yeah, but the Nydorf book talks a little more about the standings than the Zurich book. This one, the standings, I mean, they do a nice job setting the stage for each round. And as you say, they, in addition to the annotations of the game, they sort of describe the context of the game before each round. But you don't get this for like the suspense of who's going to win the tournament. I mean, obviously, looking backward, you're going to know anyway. But that's not what makes this a great book.
Yeah, it was an amazing victory by Topalov, a point and a half ahead of the rest of the field. And it's rare to win a candidates tournament, which is, again, the format of this and the level of competition, right, by that much, right? Usually it's a point or sometimes less, or even Magnus Carlsen didn't even win the candidates tournament, aside from tiebreaks when he qualified to play the world championship. So an amazing performance by Topalov. And there's a sentence in the book somewhere marveling at how inconceivable it is that he could score 6.5 out of the first seven rounds. But then, of course, Caruana scored 7 out of the first 7 rounds in an equally strong tournament in 2014 and beat Topalov twice in doing it. So it can be done, but I think I can imagine how hard it must have been for Anand and Svidler ultimately tied for second with Anand for them to try to come back after that opening performance.
Yeah, and again, that sort of standout performance is why we're going to tease again that there were accusations that Topalov was getting some sort of assistance that are mentioned both in the book. You can find stuff on the internet, and we're going to leave that as a tease to keep you guys tuned in. We'll get into all the drama later, but a couple other things. I did want to chase down what the authors are up to these days, because as Chris alluded to, they don't seem super active. They haven't written other books. So I emailed Jakob Ågard, of course, who had a hand in publishing this. And he said that that Gershon, I believe it is, has vanished into thin air, is his quotes. If you look up his Wikipedia page, he broke the record for the largest simul in 2010, played 523 people. But other than that, he doesn't have a big online profile. But I did find that he's still playing in an Israeli league, and so is Igor Nor, who Ågard says became a successful computer whiz. So they're both still playing chess. But they haven't written anything since then. But, maybe they'll reunify for some tournament book. And then to the topic of tournament books, there haven't been as many in recent years. And what you hear if you read forums like the Facebook Chess Book Collectors Group, they always say tournament books don't sell. So I asked GM Ågard if that was true in his experience as a publisher. And he unfortunately confirmed it, said they don't have any current plans to publish future tournament books, but he wouldn't rule it out. But it's kind of a bummer, isn't it?
Yeah, I sort of see the point, because I'll have to confess it was hard for me to go through this book. And despite the fact that I knew that I went through some of the games, and the annotation is incredible and the players are great and I'm interested in the opening. So there was really nothing deterring me. It wasn't like it was a whole book full of, I don't know, Queens Indians or something like that. And I didn't, I just was going to somehow feel like I didn't like the openings, but for some reason it's hard to go through this kind of book. But I think you get a lot out of it if you do, can I ask you a quiz question, Ben, about the tournament? Well, while we're here, this will help me with my argument about the book.
Sure.
This is an easy one. What opening was played most often in this tournament?
I mean, the Sicilian doesn't count, right? The broad Sicilian.
The Sicilian, sure. No, that's good. That's good enough. The Sicilian was played in 25 out of 56 games,
okay,
which is a huge percentage. And in fact, 50 out of 56 games were 1-e4. So if you're a 1-e4 player, or a Sicilian player or whatever, this is incredible. It's true that the variations they were playing in 2005 are not exactly what are played at the top level now, but still you've got, Neidorf variations, Sveshnikov, and the structures, are timeless, and the themes are timeless, even if it's not exactly the way they're playing it nowadays. But for some reason, the fact that it was a book on a tournament rather than a book on like how to play the Night Orb or something like that, just it's hard. It was hard for me to sort of think, oh, I should really be like studying this as opposed to studying something else or doing whatever I might do to try to get better. So, but I think it was that's a mistake, because there's an incredible amount you can learn from studying this stuff, even if it doesn't seem like the most intuitive way to learn.
It's still a great
way. And the annotations are so good that you'll learn more from this than most tournament books or most games collections, I think.
Yeah, no, but it's a good point. I hadn't thought about it, but if I weren't doing this podcast on it, I would have been, first of all, I've had this book and all it's done is sit on my shelf. I've never even looked at it, but I think its proper place would be like, it's like a coffee table book. Like, it would be nice to have out and pick up and just look through once in a while. But, I guess part of the issue why these books may not sell is, as you say, if your primary goal is to improve at chess, you this probably wouldn't be your first choice. And I've got a quote from Agard about that in a minute. And even if you're interested in chess history, like, it takes a certain level of diligence where if you're getting out the chess set and you're reading, I mean, there's a lot of games in this very extensively annotated. I mean, Chris and I have been working on this for months. There's no automatic target audience, and especially like with the classics, the New York 1924s and Zurich 1953s and World Championship 1948s, I mean, you're covering stuff that was not covered in real time as much. And like, there's, you can learn so much historical info, which, as we alluded to, that was some motivation for us, but it's contemporary enough where it's not not as big a driver, I would think, for a lot of people. To add before I read the Agard quote, Chris?
We have live coverage now on, essentially, we have TV shows that show you every move of every game of tournaments like this and analyze them in real time and so on. That was like a dream even in the 70s, where they would do it for the World Championship match, maybe, and they, in a very hokey format and so on. So tournaments, I think, are well followed that way. I think, you know, the new, to me, like, the interesting thing to do with tournament books is to write a book on the history of a particular tournament, like those masterpieces and dramas of the Soviet championships. Mm-hmm. You get like 10, you know, you get like 30 pages on each tournament, and it's a lot of anecdotes and stories and drama and a few key games and positions, you know, and so on. Whereas here in this book, you get the real classical tournament book, like every single move of every game is dissected, right? That's the classic. But nowadays, that's happening, you know, on broadcasts, right? Where you've got top players and engines dissecting every move of every game in real time. Not to this depth, of course, but still, it sort of takes up that space a little bit. So now it's more interesting to read a book that tells you about what's the history of Vikon Zay, or, the Soviet championship, or something more along those lines.
Yeah, and that's what Agard said. He said when vis-a-vis publishing these books in the future, he said, when I saw the book on the 2020 to 21 candidates, I like my own magazine articles better. I think that's the appropriate format. So even if you set aside any bias about his own magazine articles, which are quite good in his defense, then the idea that, yeah, these can be covered in real time or at minimum in like a magazine, which I guess you could subsequently turn into a book. But anyway, I mean, the bottom line is we know why these books aren't selling as well. But we do want to share a bit more about these books, whether you will ultimately decide to purchase it or if this is your substitute for the book. There's some great memorable quotes, as Chris said. The chess is very fighting. There's some classic games. I want to share a few details about the intro and the preface. One thing from Nigel Short's intro, it's funny to read it here in 2023 because he basically just ravages FIDE throughout the...
The more things change, yeah, the more they stay the same, right?
Except now he works for them. So he's like lampooning their disorganization and talking about, how the prize fund could have been better and stuff like that. But I guess he's left, but I mean, very recently was then on the other side of the ledger. But here's a quote from what he wrote. He asked, when people question why FIDE has been incapable of attracting major corporate sponsorship over the last decade or so, they need look no further than the regulations of the World Championship with its massive institutionalized gravy train for their answers. No serious company is going to tolerate such waste. So I can't say I disagree, but it was funny to read since he's subsequently his roles changed. And then Mikhail Marin, of course, wrote a nice and poetic, some nice words in his preface. He says he was talking about how excited he was to be going to this historic event. He'd come to terms with the fact that obviously he's a grandmaster, but not going to be playing on the biggest stage like these players are, but he's there to assist Yuta Polgar. And he writes, I was going to breathe the same air as the strongest players in the world to measure my strength against them in the background analytical contest. But what thrilled me most was the possibility of watching close up from a very favorable angle, the birth of a new world champion, to understand these details that made a decisive difference between the titans of similar strength. And one thing they say that does make a difference is both Marin and then later in the book, they just write about how relaxed Topalov was. It's funny to see. They talk about how, like, a lot of the players, obviously, before the rounds would decamp to their rooms and be, like, prepping intensely. And Topalov would come down and have breakfast and then just be, like, chilling in the lobby, like, relaxing, talking to people before the round, and then just, like, summarily crush people. So, again, might have contributed
to... Very suspicious, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I love that passage you read from Marin. And I sort of, you know, I feel the same way. I visited a couple of world championship matches over the years, and it really does feel like you're in a special place and you're somehow like breathing some history or something. Like, I mean, here they literally were all breathing the same air in that, you know, in that same dining room and so on the whole time. But I sort of get this, you can sort of feel the history happening or something when you're there. And I also sympathize with what Nigel Short wrote, because when you hold the world championship of a sport in sort of these obscure locations, that does not help in getting corporate sponsorship, which has historically been a problem for chess ever since the very beginning. There was never a time when chess had continuous, ongoing, high-level corporate sponsorship the way, you know, soccer or any other sport does. I don't think. Somehow it survives. Somehow it survives, and even, you know, well, I don't want to say it prospers, but you know, it certainly seems to be prospering now more than a lot of times. And just despite the fact that Nike is not sponsoring chess or beer companies or whatever, you know?
Yeah. But even now, I mean, where you have, I feel like there's often good corporate sponsorship for the online events. There's Twitch streamers signing with streaming companies, stuff like that. The actual world championship, which does get, again, to Nigel's comments, the actual world championship does have some trouble. And he talks about how, like, when he got there, first of all, he talks about, like, the rickety plane ride there. But then when he got there, they had him, like, examine the conditions of the match, make sure the bathrooms are in close proximity, stuff like that. And he was saying, like, shouldn't this stuff have been done before the tournament? Like, you know, it's starting tomorrow. There's not much we can do about it at this point. And it is a valid point, and it is emblematic.
Yeah. Well, and again, who can forget that at the Candidates Tournament, in 2018, I believe, Alexander Grishuk supposedly had a bottle, you know, to substitute for the bathroom, although apparently that was not actually what he was using it for. But the bathrooms are a perennial source of complaint, and some of these organizers don't seem to realize that it's important to be able to go in the middle of the game. Maybe what's going on partly is that the chess world is like the only sport where it moves the championship like to some random place in the world every 2 years or something like that. All other sports, it's like a regular tour. Everything's in the same place every time and so on. Maybe we're handicapping ourselves by having it newly, freshly done every cycle or something like that. Maybe there should be longer term deals or whatever. But you know, what is consistent long term is that we always seem to have tournaments like this. They seem to come up, you know, from time to time for one reason or another, and we have more of them now than ever before, actually. So
tournaments like
like the tournaments where you have so many strong players playing each other at once. Like if you look back at like the old great tournament books, one of the reasons why they're the great tournament books is that there weren't that many great tournaments back then. Right. So New York 1924 was the only great tournament of 1924, probably. But now we have like Wannsee, and then we have something in Germany, and then we have something in St. Louis. And we're spoiled nowadays, you know, for this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And obviously that doesn't even get into all the online stuff.
Right. Yeah. Never mind that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Chris, we're going to take one more break. I mean, among other topics, we still need to discuss the cheating scandal, wrap up the book. And then, of course, since Chris is here, we're also going to hear a bit about his upcoming book and his recent OTB Chess. So we will be right back. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. Aim Chess has an algorithm that gathers your games from the major chess playing sites like chess.com and LeeChess, and then gives you actionable intel on how to improve your game. It evaluates different phases of the game, tells you how you're doing with certain openings, and they're constantly rolling out new features to make Aim Chess even better. Some of the new ones include a blunder preventer drill that you can do, and they've now got blindfold exercises where you can work on your chess visualization skills. So be sure to check out Aim Chess if you have not already. And if you decide to subscribe, then use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. You can also click on the link in the show description to aimchess.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. And since we're audio only, of course, we won't discuss the games too much. But there are some crazy games, some real barn burners. And again, because of the opening choices, you get a lot of wide open games, a lot of back and forth affairs. So Chris, do you have any games that you found of particular interest?
I do. And there are so many good games that I thought I would. It's hard to pick out which ones are the best, although a couple of really stand out in my mind. So I had heard about this new feature in Chessbase 17 where it tells you how beautiful a game is.
Oh, right.
So I asked my coach, Eric Kislik, who's a Chessbase whiz, to tell me what Chessbase thought were the best games. And it's not just like the editors of Chessbase. They have some algorithm that sort of, you know, tries to process the game. So it's like, it's kind of like asking ChatGPT to tell you what you should believe and so on. I had him ask Chessbase, and they give 3, 2, and 1 star for beauty. And the 3-star game was the game where Judit Polgar was white against Kazymjanov. And it's one of those Sicilians where like white sacrifices a piece very early on and gets this long-term attack. It's not sort of an immediate, you know, payoff. It's a long-term attack with pressure and a really beautiful win by Judit. That's the only 3-star game of the tournament. But there's one game in the tournament that made the mammoth book of the greatest chess games of all time, which we've talked about before, which is the win by Anand against Adams, which is a great attacking game in the Royal Lopez. So 1 Sicilian, 1 Royal Lopez. The Royal Lopez is the second most common opening in this tournament, which makes sense. The other one I guess I would mention is, I mentioned 2 others. One is Kazymjanov's win against Polgar, so revenge in a later round, which is another amazing win in the Sicilian. It's amazing how much risk these people were taking back in 2005. No Catalans, yeah. Not too many Slavs, and Queen's Gambit declines, and no 1b3, and all that. And then the last one is the very first game in the tournament. Well, it's the very first game in the book, but it was a game in the first round where Topalov played the Sicilian as black. He played the knight orf, which was his thing. You know, I think the book calls it his pet opening or something like that. In the annotations against Peter Lecoq, and it's a very back and forth game. And Lecoq could have won. I mean, he had a clear win at one point in the game. Didn't find it, and it's not some crazy engine line. You know, that was only discovered later. It's right there, and it's right there in the notes. And if that game had gone differently, the whole course of the tournament could have been much different. Maybe Topalov was so calm, cool, and collected because he had started winning early on.
Right.
Since most of these things are won with a score of +4 or even +3, you know, once he had built up that kind of lead, that might have, I guess it could make some people more nervous and anxious, but it might have helped him realize he had a little bit of a cushion as well. But those are all great games. There's so many good ones. One of the funny things the annotators say at some point is that Morozevich played the French in one game against Anand, which is a crazy draw, repetition draw, which is really interesting. They say maybe Morozevich played the French because he was tired out from the wild Petrov of the round before. And at first I thought that was a joke. The Petrov was played 5 times in this tournament, which was, I think, the 3rd most common opening. But I look back at that game, and yes, it was a wild Petrov. So even the Petrovs were wild in this tournament. There are a lot of games that are worth just playing through, even if you don't want to play through all the notes. Just read the words, and look at the main lines they give or something like that. So many good games.
Yeah, the authors had a quote: "Luckily for us, there are not many fans of the Petrov in the tournament, while there are Sicilianistas of every kind." So that's why I was able to get your trivia question, although the harder one would have been like which version of the Sicilian was most prevalent. But there,
were a lot of, there were a lot of Nydorfs. So it's,
yeah, for sure. Nydorf and Svechnikov, I think, are the two main candidates. Yeah. But I think Nydorf probably would be the winner, which obviously makes for some entertaining chess.
Yeah. The other thing, I guess another thing I would say about the way the game analysis is done, and they start with something interesting, which I haven't seen in all of their tournament books like this, which is a sort of a historical analysis of the encounters between all the pairs of players. So with eight players, there are 28 pairs, and they review like the record of each player against each other player, and some like highlights of their recent games, including like the most recent ones before the tournament. So what would have been on their mind? Well, the last game they played, you know, this person lost to that person, or you know, something like that. It's a very it's a lengthy but sort of unique, you know, preamble to the book, which maybe takes the place of some of the stuff that's missing. So it's so much into the chess that it's hard to find some details in the book, like what were the dates that they played these games on, and what were the dates of the rounds, and when was their rest day? Like, it would be nice if there was like I didn't notice a chronology or something like that, or the sort of history leading up to the event, like how the tournament wound up being there and so on. That you have to sort of learn that from like reading about Short's complaints about FIDE and, and so on, as opposed to from the authors of the of the book. And the authors are so elusive that there's no about the authors.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
You know, like usually pretty standard. So it's really relentlessly like on, you know, the chess. Unfortunately, the games were for the most part so good. Even the 24 move draws are really, you know, are fairly, you know, fairly interesting. And there aren't too many.
Yeah, I would say that I wish that there would be an updated edition, you know, with like a bit more historical context. You know, I've talked before about how someone should write a book about the deunification of FIDE from the 1990s through this period, through 2006. And that could be the foreword to this, you know, the prelude to this book. And then you could update it with, you know, some more engine comments and stuff. But given what we've already said about the unpopularity of tournament books, unfortunately, I don't think we should hold our breath.
Well, that is such a drama that could be just like a regular nonfiction book without any diagrams or moves in it at all, with all the personalities. Like if someone, like, you know, that book, like Bobby Fischer Goes to War and so on, there's some interesting, just pure nonfiction narrative books about some of these interesting chess episodes. That could be one of them right there.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a book on the, there's sort of a book on the beginning of that. There's a book on the Kasparov short match in 1993, which was the first non-FIDE World Championship match, written by Dominic Lawson, who's a British journalist, which is very much like that. And he, you know, he talks to a lot of the people involved and so on. So it's very much like a journalistic account of that whole thing.
Yet another book that's sitting unread on my shelf. Is that one called Endgame? Does it have the same name as the Brady book?
Same title as Wayne Brady's biography of Bobby Fischer. So it's such a good, I can see all the editors at all the, you know, the New York publisher saying, oh, Endgame, what a great name for a chess book, you know,
and right.
used a few times, you know?
Yeah.
So this is not that, you know, this is not that book, but it's not like it's all like moves and informator symbols. Like there's tons of like textual discussion of the positions and so on, which is really good.
Yeah. And descriptions of, the sort of, continents, the way the people were sitting and they talk a lot about the nerves of the players. They say at some point, nervous struggles took place on every board. Even the extraordinary calm Anand could not stand the stress. And I think that also, in addition to the openings, as you say, being such fighting choices, like that contributed to sort of some up and down games, but also from what the authors said, I mean, it just sounded like, you know, the stage was so big. I mean, it's a tournament for the world championship, even though now we may look back at it as a semi-world championship, semi-candidates, although Topalov's name is on the list of world champions, and he was certainly not the weakest world champion, so he certainly belongs there. But anyway, I mean, the fact that the players, like the description of the heightened tension, I also found enjoyable.
Yeah, for sure. They do take a fairly psychological view of, you know, of things in that, you know, in that way as well.
Yeah. And I had another quote from Agard to share, because getting back to what we were saying about this not being the first book you would choose as something educational. You had submitted a question for him, Chris, which I appreciated, was would he recommend that someone use this book to improve their own games? And what he said is, on those notes, he said, I think you can learn a lot about how to win tournaments and the dangers you face. He mentioned Nigel Short's book, Winning. He said, but the games themselves are fabulously instructive. Well-annotated games are always educational, which, yeah, I agree with. It's just, you know, we're always, there's so many books and so little time that it's, that I recommend picking this book, but neither of us had read it. So that speaks for itself.
I'm looking forward to winning more tournaments now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think I might need more than one book for that. So any other things to note from the book before we get to the cheating of it all, Chris?
I don't think anyone will, you know, if anyone buys this book, I don't really know if it's still in print, but I'm sure you can still get it. If anyone buys it or acquires it somehow, I don't think you'll ever regret having it in your collection. You might rather regret like not finding the time to study it or something like that. So if you can handle that dissonance, like being proud of having a book and yet not disgusted with yourself for not having read it and studied it, then you should definitely have this, because I do think it's one of the best tournament books of all time. I think it's up there with, I mean, Zurich 1953 is very controversial, of course, but you know, certainly people love it. And it meant a lot to me when I read it, but I think it's up there with like the Match of the Century, and the second Piotrkowski Cup is another one, and New York 1924 people like a lot. It's really right up there with the best ones.
Yeah, I know esteemed chess historian Douglas Griffin is a big fan of Kovalik's Vikingsey 1975. That's another one I haven't, but would like to read. But just checking Amazon, it looks like you can still get it. It's even, if anything, maybe it's come down a bit in price. It looks like you can get it for $25 to $30. So I agree. Worth having to collect dust on your shelf with the other tournament classics. Although if you can find the time to read it, all the better.
And you can get a lot out of it without going through all the variations. So don't be daunted by the fact that there are like 7 pages on every game. You can actually go through it, you know, without playing out all the variations, and you won't be like cheating yourself somehow.
Yeah. And again, with the games being in Elite Chess Study, it's an easy way to play through it. Did you actually use a set for this, Chris?
No, I used the study. I made that study by getting the games from another.
Oh, you did it yourself. Oh, thanks. Thanks yes. for doing that.
I got the games from another source and put them all in there because I couldn't find one that already had them. So I just made one because I figured it would be easier. And I had ambitions to do things like run them through the Elite Chess engine and see sort of what the accuracy scores were and so on. But I think Leechess like blocked me after I did too many games in a row like that or something like that. But I did find that Topalov played very accurately in the first 5 rounds, at least, and not surprisingly. And some of his opponents played less well. But I, you know, to lead into the next topic, that's, I think, just a common sort of post hoc fallacy that once someone points to someone and says that person is suspicious, and then you look back and say, oh, they played very accurately. Well, nobody would have thought they were cheating unless they were playing well in the first place, right?
Right.
So it's a circular line of reasoning.
Yeah, and obviously with echoes of recent controversies. Yeah, and they discuss the cheating allegations. Marin discusses them a little bit in the intro, and then they have like a separate epilogue where they talk about it. So, I mean, basically what you need to know if you haven't read the book is that one thing that made people suspicious, and they don't name the player who made the primary accusation, although if you do some internet sleuthing, you can make an educated guess, but then they say a few people were suspicious. But one thing they say that was suspicious was that he sat at the same table every day, so that they're thinking that if there's some sort of signaling coming from his team, which they don't actually say how the cheating would have taken place, again, with echoes of modern times, but if there were some sort of signaling, I guess maybe that would make it easier. But then they do discuss the relative quality of the games. And yes, he played the highest standard in the tournament, but there also were some up and down affairs where he wasn't just playing computer moves. There was a game where he missed for 2700 standards, an easy win. And he even had a rating jump. I mean, he wasn't a teenager like Hans Niemann, but Topalov even had a rating jump. So yeah, it was, especially in light of recent events, it was really interesting to read about these accusations.
Yeah, they have a very interesting, short, but very interesting and detail-packed epilogue about this. And I think these authors take an appropriately skeptical view towards allegations of cheating based on the quality of the performance. And I think one reason why people, well, usually there's some reason outside of the chess that leads people to suspect that. And in the more recent cases, I guess we're not naming names, but there have been previous suspicions, previous admissions, so on. People seem to, I think people discount the amount of variability there can be in performance. Like, just as people can have horrible, runs of horrible games, they can also have runs of really great games. And a lot depends on the circumstances, and you have different opponents. So it's sort of like rolling, flipping five heads in a row or something like that. That's going to happen one out of 32 times. It's not an unheard of, it's not an unheard of event. Now, of course, one would say like, oh, well, there's 40 moves in every game, and that's, and so on. But of course, the moves are not all uniformly perfect. And as they note in the epilogue, if you want to test someone's games to see whether they're somehow sort of too perfect or too engine-like or whatever, you've also got to observe the fact that when those people couldn't possibly have been cheating or when they were much lower strength, they played games that were equally as impressive every so often. So, as I believe they observe, it's more sort of the consistency that maybe changes than the play. Like, Topalov was always capable of playing these games. He managed to string together, a lot in a row. Reading about this reminded me just today, as we were getting ready to record this, of a recent paper in cognitive psychology that I saw. Well, it's recent; it's 8 years ago, but in the world of science, 8 years ago is recent. The authors pointed out that what we normally think of as a learning curve, normally we imagine that sort of people get better smoothly at something, and the longer they work on it, the better they get. And of course, it plateaus eventually, right? You first get better quickly, and then you slow down, but you sort of keep on getting better. But there's only a curve of learning when you average together a lot of people's learning experiences and the way their performance changes over time. If you look at individual players or athletes or, people doing any kind of task, what's more likely is they have an upward curve for a little while and then they flatten out. And then there's like a discontinuity where they start a new curve and go up. So it's like plateaus and climbs and plateaus and climbs. And the plateaus can get longer as you go, as you go along, as you get better and better. It seems like, it's fair to think that players who in retrospect maybe are thought of as potential cheaters or otherwise doing, cheaters, and to use the bluntest word, might be just having a pattern of performance, which is not really all that unexpected. It's just not what people, well, I shouldn't say that. It's not what people expect, but it's not illegitimate. It's actually reflects, the actual way people improve. We don't get, 0.001% better at chess every day, right? We stay the same for a while, and then something's happening in our mind and also with the rest of our bodies and our lives and so on. And then we're able to sort of make a new jump. Sometimes people talk about conceptual reorganization. You sort of like have somewhat different way of thinking about things. And I don't see any reason to think that that's not what happened with a player like Topalov. I don't know him. I don't know exactly what happened, but the kind of evidence that people have offered is really weak. I mean, much weaker than they realize, I think.
Yeah. I mean, unless there's like more to the story that's not presented in the book, it just seemed like total speculation. I mean, his rating gain, just for context, they say in the epilogue, his rating stayed relatively the same from 1996 to 2003. And then he went from 2730 to 2800 in about 2 years. But that's including this tournament, which obviously contributed a decent amount. Age-wise, he was about 30 by 2005. So still narrowly on the right side of the aging curve in terms of what little we know about like peak performance in chess. I just didn't
remember,
see.
Remember, every time someone says peak performance is at this year, that means on average,
right?
There are people who are in better shape, who have different genes, who have different backgrounds, and so on. They might peak later or earlier. I mean, we all know there have been some players who peaked very early and then they've been flat forever. And there could be all kinds of reasons for that, right? Flat or declining forever. So those are not enough evidence. Like, if you were making a circumstantial case in a trial, you would need like so many pieces of evidence like that, and you need to show that those things were so unlikely to happen in combination, right? That this is like a one in a million, or one in, and that becomes, those kinds of arguments become very tricky to make statistically, because you really need to know like how likely it is that these things can happen and happen in combination. And I would much rather have some video and eyewitnesses and unimpeachable sources, you know, actually explain exactly what was going on. Like you say, like, where was the information coming from? You know, what did the yogurt flavors mean?
Right.
What was in the chair when they x-rayed it or whatever, like something more tangible than it's suspicious that he played so well in this tournament after, you know, only being a 27-30 for, you know, for a few years or something like that. That just, I don't think that's, I mean, it's not, doesn't happen every day. You wouldn't have picked a 27-30 player to win the tournament, but anyone could have won this tournament.
Yeah. Yeah. And someone has to. And the authors wrote, one could say Anand and Lecoq played below their normal strength in this tournament, and that's true. But Topalov's play over the past 1.5 years, this is at the time of the tournament, has been the best. So the tournament did not reveal any great secret.
Yeah, that's another thing. Is also your opponents often have to cooperate for you to have a great tournament, and sometimes a lot of them cooperate.
Right.
Right? Yeah. You know, love Caruana. He went 7-0 and 8.5, you know, out of 10. But, you know, probably his opponents didn't play as many, you know, great moves as they normally do. That's how you win games often. Your opponents don't play the best moves.
Yeah. And they ended on a poetic note in their epilogue. And again, I feel like the authors did a great job. I don't know if I'd go so far as saying debunking, because we never know 100%, but the bottom line is there's no evidence. So they say, we would like to end this book with the hope that in the future, chess will attract the crowds with its beauty rather than by foolish conspiracy theories. Which,
so prophetic.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very ironic to read that today. And it gets to the Niemann story. I mean, not to rehash it too much, but part of me still wonders, because to me, my opinions haven't changed from when I was covering it regularly, that there's just not compelling evidence. I've talked to people who know Hans who say, you know, I wouldn't rule it out that he cheated. It's entirely possible, but there's no evidence. So the only thing I cling to is, like, maybe someone told Magnus of something they witnessed, and he just doesn't feel like he can say it due to the legal constraints. And I'm not necessarily talking about the Sinkfield Cup in particular, because I still find it really, even it strains credulity even more than general OTB cheating accusations that he cheated in St. Louis at that tournament. But I still, there's part of me that wonders, maybe Magnus did get a reliable firsthand account that he's unable to relay. But see, when I say that, that's so much hearsay, you know? So
it sounds like it's speculation of hearsay or something.
Yeah,
like
that. Exactly. But that's the only way that, like, everyone's behavior on the accusation side is justifiable in my mind.
I'm a Magnus fan, but there's a tendency to sort of assume that someone who's great at one thing or the greatest at one thing is sort of omniscient in other things. And I don't think he's any, you know, he's probably better at figuring out who's cheating in chess than almost anybody else in chess, but he's not perfect. And it's possible that he's wrong in this case. And he has emotions just like anybody else, and he can be flustered, and you know, he can, you know, if there are things in his mind, like, you know, Hans is kind of a jerk. Hans beat me twice in 2 months, one time in the Rapid tournament the month before in Miami, one time at the Sinkfield Cup. And that was with Black, both times, I believe. Black one time, White one time. And, you know, everybody knew. I mean, a lot of people knew, let's put it this way, that he had cheated online before. He definitely had cheated before, you know, online. And I agree with, I disagree with the people who say online cheating is nothing. You know, that's important. Like, you're not supposed to cheat online or anywhere else. You're not supposed to do it twice in a row. You're not supposed to do it when you're 15 or 16 or whatever, but of course you won't understand as well when you're younger, you know, often. But that's, you know, there are a lot of other people who have cheated online, and there are a lot of other people about whom there are rumors. And I don't think that's, you know, I don't think that's enough. It's funny how there were people find the same signs though. Like, and I understand why they do. Like, Magnus, I think, said that Hans just seemed too relaxed during their game. Like, almost like he had, like, didn't, you know, like he stopped preparing, you know, and had a calm breakfast, you know, before, like yeah, exactly. Topalov did or something like that, you know, or whatever. Like, he didn't seem to be paying attention. You know, it's all something, but it's not enough. And I sort of don't, I mean, my feelings about this change every time I see some new information, but I sort of don't blame Magnus as much as I blame all the people who sort of jumped on it and, having got the hypothesis, you know, Hans is an inveterate cheater, they started doing all kinds of, I don't want to say bogus, but, you know, invalid analyses of his previous play without appropriate comparisons, without understanding even what the numbers were that they were looking at or where they came from. David Smerdon and Jonathan Rowson, I think, reviewed all this very well with you in your interviews with them at the time. It was all pretty apparent to people who knew what was going on, you know, that all of this so-called evidence and these YouTube videos that everyone was passing around, you know, didn't really prove anything. And, you know, there have been real cheaters in high-level tournaments like the Olympiad and, you know, and so on. There's Igor Rausis, you know, there's the French guy from the Olympiad. I mean, this is like a serious problem. Like, I'm not trying to downplay it at all. It's a serious problem. And, you know, I just finished writing a whole book, co-authoring a whole book essentially about cheating and, you know, and so on. So it's a serious problem, but it's equally serious to do a bad investigation, I think, of such allegations.
Well said. We're on the same page. So did the Niemann story make it into your book, Chris?
I think we had finished the book. Like, we had finished the first draft right when it came out. So we talk about some other cheating stuff and in chess and so on. And I think we had to add mention it in a footnote. It really was all in that one case was every element of, you know, the topic of, you know, how people think about situations like this and how people weigh the evidence. Like, it was a, you know, you could do a master class about, like, how, you know, how to make decisions about things like this and how people think about topics like this. And I, you know, maybe we'll get back into it in the future or something like that.
That would be fun. And we have a question from Brian Karen of the aforementioned Facebook chess book collectors group, which is, has your expertise in cognitive psychology helped you as a chess player?
It probably has, but probably not as much as I wish it had. I did acquire some naive ideas about chess from reading the cognitive psychology literature about chess. So I first got interested in psychology because I was interested in computer science and artificial intelligence. And then that sort of moved me into, like, how humans think from how computers might think. And this was, of course, artificial intelligence back in the 80s, not what we think of now as artificial intelligence. And, you know, one of the main theories in cognitive psychology about expertise at the time was that the experts have this massive repertoire of these little patterns, you know, chunks they were sometimes called, but they're sort of like little patterns of things on the chessboard, like the fianchettoed bishop and, you know, the locked pawn chain and, you know, pieces attacking other pieces and so on. And somehow the way, you know, what made experts different from other players is the experts would sort of see these patterns and recognize the configurations and unconsciously think of what were good moves to play. And there's some truth in that. Like, if you see, you know, if you have a pawn on h5 and your opponent has a bishop fianchettoed on g2 with pawns on h2 and g3, you think h4, like, we must bust open the king position, but you don't even think about that. You just think h4 is a candidate move that occurs to you, right? And part of being good at chess, I think, is automatically thinking of the right candidate moves, which is a lot of that kind of pattern recognition. But I think I overestimated that, and I didn't realize how important it was to think more abstractly in chess. So I think and also how important it was to train it as a skill. Like, it sort of felt to me more like a knowledge-based thing than a skill-based thing. And of course, we all realize now, and all the top trainers say, you know, you've got to keep on, you know, you've got to keep on doing your tactics and your calculation and all that kind of stuff. If only I had trained, you know, on chess back when I was doing all this stuff, I would be, you know, a better player now, you know? So I think it has its pros and its cons, and, you know, but also not just cognitive psychology, but psychology and understanding skill and variability in performance, like I was talking about before. I think it has maybe helped me not be so upset about the most recent performance. Like, I used to get really upset if I would lose a game to a really low rated player. I would think, oh, I can't play this game anymore, you know, but then, well, that was one game, you know, like, there's much more variability than we realize. And it gets greater as we get older. Like, the variability gets more as we get older.
Oh, interesting. I'm going to definitely tell myself that.
That's a subjective experience. I think it might not be that we can, like, have more great peaks, but we're more subject to having, like, a big low, and it can be based on physiological things, right? Like, not enough caffeine, not enough sleep. Those things affect us, I think, more you know, as we get older. So it becomes more important to manage that aspect of things. And that's not cognitive psychology, but I think understanding sort of like how skill changes over the lifespan and the factors that affect skilled performance and so on does help a little bit put things into perspective when you're actually in it yourself, kind of like maybe having a sports psychologist, you know, to work with you if you were an athlete or something.
That's fascinating. And did you just, I know you, so once you finished your book, you played at least one tournament. Did you play more than one or just the one in Maryland?
Just one so far. So I hadn't played in a classical tournament in 18 months myself. And my son had taken a break of about 5 or 6 months because he had soccer season. So we went and played in one of Ken Regan's great Maryland tournaments, the Baltimore Open. And I held off the kids for a while. But then on the third day, you know, rounds 4 and 5, those are the killers. Had a really interesting, well, I drew with an international master with Black, which was nice, a very, very nice guy, strong player. And then, unfortunately I lost as Black in a very interesting Nydorf. And then in the final round, my biggest blunder was driving past Dunkin' Donuts on the way back to the game in the final round and not stopping and getting a big coffee.
Right.
So the biggest blunder was made before the game. Nonetheless, I achieved a good position, but it just sort of fell apart in time pressure. And it wound up about, you know, with an even score and not losing too many rating points. So, you know, if that's how I was doing after 18 months, I'm going to take that as a positive. Like after an 18-month break, I played some good moves and I didn't have any total disasters. So we're going to play again in, end of February. And I'm, you know, really want this time period to be one where I can try to play like a tournament a month and just see what happens. Like, yeah. You know, as Eric Kislik and others remind us, playing games, especially classical games, is actually the best form of training. I'm going to see if I can follow that, take that advice to heart and see what happens if I can do it for a few months in a row and, which I haven't been able to put together, you know, recently. So wish me luck.
Yeah, good luck. I mean, I struggle with it too, because I just getting back into it in the past couple of years, that was my main realization, is that playing, as you say, playing is the training. It's the one thing that, because so much of chess is like decision management, that's where you get the practice at that. And that's where I actually remember the lessons imparted, as opposed to stuff online. My last tournament was pretty bad. The kids got me for sure, a couple bad openings, and they played really well. So I really shouldn't, like, I lost a bunch of rating, but really, like, if you look at the quality of the games, I shouldn't have too much to be upset about, but it still stings. And then the other thing, Chris, of course, as we were talking about before we're recording, is now I'm working on a book. So I'm afraid I'm going to lose some momentum. I'm playing in Alto in Charlotte. If anyone listening is going, please come say hi. So I'll play that in March. But other than that, my current thinking is I'll be inactive for the most part until I get this book completed.
Well, there's only so much time in the day and the week and the month and so on, right? I'm sure I've said this before, but the great thing about chess is that somehow, like, so much of it stays in our mind that we can, like, not play for 9 months while we're finishing a book and come back. And although we're a little worse, it doesn't feel like we're doing something different, you know, and it feels like we can sort of pick up where we left off, and in to a large extent we can, and we can regain our level, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe get better. That's a beautiful thing about chess compared to like some other, you know, performance-based, you know, sports or skills or whatever, where, you know, you can, you know, your fitness matters a lot more, and your, you know, strength and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really just a matter of getting a few tournaments back under you when you come back, I think.
You have to be willing to accept the consequences for a little while, you know, and I was,
right.
I was ready for the consequences at this last tournament, and they weren't as bad as I feared. So, you know, let's see if I can keep going.
Glad to hear it. Well, Chris, when your book comes out, of course, I'm looking forward to reading it, and we'll have to do a proper interview. We've been doing so many book reviews. It's time for you to relax and just be interviewed in what is it, July, did I say?
Yes, it comes out on July 11th. Everybody can pre-order on your favorite place where you can get books. And there is some stuff about chess in there, but also a lot of other things I think people interested in chess would find interesting also.
Okay, excellent. And again, it is called Nobody's Fool. Well, as we wrap up, Chris, anything to add, whether about San Luis 2005 or chess generally?
I guess the one thing I would say is that, I really liked your episode with Karsten Hansen going over the unappreciated books or whatever you called them. And it made me realize that there's so many good books coming out nowadays. We should do another interview just on like, what are the cool, new books that, that people aren't talking about, because I see so many interesting ones. If you look at the quality chess publishing schedule, they're going to put out like 10 great books in the next year. Good luck, good luck to them getting all that done, and so on. But, I think somehow it's a golden age of chess books, even though supposedly nobody reads them anymore. So I don't quite understand how that works. People are still putting in a lot of effort making great chess books. Supposedly nobody reads them. It's a paradox for me, but I enjoy them, so I'm happy with it.
Yeah, me too. But yeah, I did see that list. I know Mauricio Flores Rios of Chess Structures Frame has a sequel coming out.
It's the wrong sequel though. Like, their Chess Structures doesn't have all the structures. Like, I even emailed him after I read the book, or like, went through the book the first time, and I said, "What about this structure and that structure and that structure?" And he wrote back and said, "Yeah, maybe those are sort of important, but And I think, Even more so today, because like the openings that are played at the top level evolve more. So you need a chapter on like structures from the Nimzo-Larsen B3 opening, and things like that. So maybe he'll get back to another sequel to Chess Structures, but I am definitely looking forward to whatever it is that he's doing. He's a really interesting guy, by the way, outside of chess.
Yeah, I did get to interview him once, and hopefully he is primarily working in outside of chess, working in like analytics for Target, last I heard, in Minnesota. Hopefully get to chat with Grandmaster Rios again. And one last book that I'm looking forward to, I mentioned this, I also, speaking of book talk, did a Dojo Talks recently that some of you listening may have heard, but if you search for Dojo Talks in the podcast app, talked even more chess books with Jesse Cry and Kostya Kavutsky and David Proust. But anyway, Axel Smith is coming out with a positional version of the Woodpecker Method, apparently. So,
that'll be interesting. Also, like Learn from the Legends, Part 2. Speaking of I know there's all kinds of great stuff. I know you go around everywhere you can trashing my system.
Yes, and I did it there too.
You're right. You're right, of course. But the reason why you're right is that nowadays we have like 100 other books which sort of can teach you the same stuff.
Of course, yeah.
And that was the only book.
Right. Yeah. No.
There were three books sort of you could get back then, right? And that was one of them. So.
And it was truly revolutionary. It's just that we don't have to read it anymore. We don't have to drive a state of the art car from 1938.
That's another common fallacy in chess books that I see, is people say like, "Oh, you must start by reading Capablanca and Lasker and so on." And that's like saying like you have to learn computer science by reading like what Turing wrote in the 1930s and what von Neumann wrote and so on. Nobody learns computer science that way. There's a little bit of history, but you learn from the best way we know now, and there's been so much improvement in how to teach chess and explain chess, and even our understanding of chess is actually much better than it was even for Capablanca and Alekhine and Imsevich and those guys. So it's a total sort of, it's like some kind of historical fallacy, like what was once great is forever great or something like that. And chess has been around for so long, maybe that's why that sort of is fostered, whereas nobody wants to study like how they played soccer in 1910 or something like that, right? Like that wouldn't help you today.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. But Chris, I'm glad to have you agreeing with me on these points. I think that's a good note to end on. But look forward to catching up later this year, and good luck with the book rollout, and of course with your upcoming tournament and any other ones that come.
All right, thank you very much. Look forward to being back sometime.
Okay, and listeners, I'll link, of course, to Dr. Shabri's Twitter account and anything else he tells me to. But thanks again, and thanks for listening. And for listeners, as I alluded to, so these book recaps are not going away, but it might be a couple months before I get a few months, I should say, before I get around to another one. But hopefully they'll become slightly more regular once my own book is done being written. Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. Thank you, Chris, and goodbye. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible.
Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, and or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on...
Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.